Testing, 1, 2. Hi, my name is Derek Viner, and I'm here today to talk to you about the film Head, starring the Monkees and directed by Bob Rafelson. The reason I chose to do this audio commentary, pretty much twofold. First off, there isn't one available, and director Bob Rafelson said in a recent interview with Mojo Magazine that he probably wouldn't ever do one. The second reason is that there are a lot of things to be said about this movie. There are a lot of theories about the meaning. There's a lot of facts about the production that are kind of scattered among different sources. And the film continues to have a following. New people are seeing it all the time and getting out there and wondering what the meanings are. And this is less of a full explanation of what it is rather than an introduction of ideas of what it might be. The film was made in early 1968, following the second season of the Monkees TV series. At the time, there was a chance that they could go on and do a third year of the series, but it was decided against because the format they wanted to go with was not going to be viable. The studio did opt to give them $750,000 to make a feature film. Rafelson and Schneider, Bert Schneider, the producers of the Monkees, contacted a friend, Jack Nicholson, brought him with the Monkees to the town of Ojai, California, where they sat around and created ideas and talked into a tape recorder for a weekend. And then Nicholson went away to write the screenplay. The theme of the film I'm pretty much going to investigate as my own personal take. Is that this film is a contrast of reality versus a manufactured image. The Monkees were hired to play the part of a band on television, but they use their real names. So the public perception of them, of the actual people, was often tainted by the characters they played on television. And the film, I believe, is an investigation of that, plus a whole deconstruction of the Monkees' history and their myth. The first scene we have here, the character here is Mayor Feedback, being played by Charles Irving. He's on the Gerald Desmond Bridge in Long Beach, California. And then the Monkees bust in. At first it might look like they are running a race and winning triumphantly, although it comes quickly apparent that they're trying to run away from something that we can't see. The first scene has a very stark reality, which is contrasted with the rest of the film, which quickly becomes a very surreal experience. And immediately we are confronted with the idea that Mickey Dolenz is going to commit suicide by jumping off a bridge. Quite a contrast to the fun-loving character that he plays on television. The song that's playing is the Porpoise Song, written by Jerry Goffin and Carole King, and it was written specifically for the movie. Some of the lyrics investigate the themes of the film in another way. One verse describes a face, a voice, an overdub has no choice, an image cannot rejoice, wanting to be, to hear and to see. And the last verse of the song continues the idea, also bringing in the concept of popularity and being popular and having things versus being real. And that verse says, "The ego sings of castles and kings and things that go with a life of style, wanting to feel, to know what is real, living is lie." The underwater footage seen here was shot in the Bahamas. One of the theories that I've read about the film on the internet is that because Mickey jumps off the bridge out of the quote-unquote real scene, that we are automatically thrown into a dream that he's having. And the indication that something that is not a real situation is that the mermaids are not real. The line that was just heard in the song, "Riding the backs of giraffes for laughs is all right for a while," is thought to be an inside joke based on the fact that Mickey Dolenz, as a child actor named Mickey Braddock, played a character in a television series called Circus Boy. A lot of the scenes here take on the look of a lucid dream type of thing. The lucid dream was recently explored in the film Vanilla Sky. And the whole film really takes on kind of a feeling of that. You don't know what's real and what's imagined. Blurring that line is really the major thing going on in the movie. And I think through that kind of unsureness, they're trying to show that the monkeys actually have that kind of feeling about their public image. Another idea I have here is that I think that by jumping off the bridge, Mickey was trying to escape from something, and he was thwarted and unsuccessful, and here he's returned by the mermaids. This is the first of many visual transitions in the film. Just about every sequence is linked by a nice transition. The underwater scene dissolves right into the image of the water in a fish tank. The set here is the same set that was used on the Monkees TV series. It's the Monkees house, or the Monkees pad. Some of the things from the set in the series, some of the more playful type of images and the kind of generic kind of decorations have been removed and replaced with many, many psychedelic type of things. Lots of lighting and chandeliers, colored lampshades like this, stained glass windows have been put in. The character we're seeing here is called Lady Pleasure. The actress's name is I.J. Jefferson. This is not her real name. The real name is Mimi Mashu, and at the time she was the girlfriend of Jack Nicholson. She appeared in other films with him, such as Psych Out and Drive, He Said. Later on, after breaking up with Jack Nicholson, she fathered a child with Sonny Bono. By going through and kissing each monkey individually, they're playing with the images of the characters that the monkeys were on television, especially this sequence here where Davy was always portrayed as the great lover in the TV show. But as she goes around and describes that they're all equal, it immediately contrasts with that idea that even what we just saw was something wildly different than the others. I think one of the things going on here is that the monkeys, as characters, all have predefined roles, of which Davies is to be the great lover. And by her stating that they're all even, they're all thrown out of whack by this. From the kissing sequence, we go right into the Diddy Diego sequence, which is kind of a statement of purpose for the movie. This image shrinks down to a small monitor, and then we're treated to samples of the major sequences coming up through the film, while the song declares what the movie is actually going to be content-wise. It talks about how the order is going to come in a strange way, that things aren't quite what they appear, and that what you might think you're getting with the monkeys isn't what you're going to see. It also does a great play on their classic theme song, "Hey, Hey, We Are the Monkees." And it also indicates the important point that when you see the end in sight, the beginning may arrive. There was a further verse that was left out that said, "To mix it all together, pictures, sounds, and songs, and time and place and weather, and even rights and wrongs." The whole thing is ended with a very distinct war footage shot, which is a captain being shot by a general for being suspected of being the Viet Cong. And immediately we've got this contrast which plays with the media idea of what you're seeing versus what's real. This sequence of the monkeys is in the Pasadena Rose Bowl doing the war chant. A some of this Vietnam War footage was actually reused by producer Bert Schneider in an Oscar-winning documentary called Hearts and Mind in 1974. I think that some people believe that this is the monkeys commenting on the Vietnam War, which gets a heavy criticism because, as Mike is popping bubblegum, it's kind of like bubblegum heroes commenting on realistic, heavy, heavy topics. But I think that the Vietnam sequence, the war sequence, really isn't a commentary on war itself, but rather a commentary on media perception of war. The very first thing that happens when Peter leaves the bunker here is that he's accosted by a photographer from Life magazine. And the photographer says, hold it, this is for Life, and his picture appears. I think the idea there is that when you're captured on film, it kind of takes an image of you for life. It's forever, or as long as that image lasts, and you're fixed in that image. The perception of you is fixed as what that photographer took, or what that filmmaker shot, as far as the monkeys are concerned. Another thing going on here is that Mickey's very unhappy with his situation, which I think is dawning that the monkeys here are playing this role, going to war. They're realizing they might not like it. They might not be happy with it. This guy is Ray Nitschke. He's a famous football player. He played for the Green Bay Packers 15 seasons from 1958 to 1972. The character he's playing is called Mr. One. And there are several interpretations for number one here. It could be that the Americans saying that they're number one in their arrogance, as some people might say. And it could also mean the pressure of being number one for the monkeys. In 1967, they actually outsold the Beatles as far as total numbers of records. There's also the golden helmet here with the stars, which Mickey wants to put on, which early on, I think one of the first things I saw in this movie that made me think that there was kind of a metaphorical meaning was that the helmet had stars, and Mickey wanted to wear it and kind of take on that role of being somewhat of a special person, a superstar. Also here, the concept of the monkeys as a team going into war is contrasted here. Again, some people find it a bit arrogant that the idea of the monkeys going into concert and going into their into the eye of the fans is nowhere near what someone going into war is really like. But again, I believe it's just a metaphorical thing to kind of get across the idea. Another great transition, the war scene is taking us right back to the hallway where the monkeys are running into the concert. Transition with a cut of fire in each. This whole concert sequence was filmed May 21st, 1968, in the Valley Auditorium in Salt Lake City. The recording of the song Circle Sky, the music was recorded live at the location, but the vocals were later redubbed in the studio. This version was not even included on the soundtrack album at the time. A studio version recorded by Mike Nesmith was included. And the first actual from a tape recording of this performance was released by Rhino Records in the late 80s on Missing Links Volume 2. To get into, like, maybe a little bit of film theory here, some of the ideas of this sequence being cut together this way with the multiple images of the monkeys intercut with the war, the multiple images seem to indicate the dual personalities of the characters of the monkeys, the real person versus the personality in the public eye. it also contrasts what the fans are excited about, which is seeing the monkeys and wanting to get them, where we're intercutting with these horrific scenes from the war of people being shot, people running, and people being oppressed. And I think it's making a comment on the monkeys are presented to the public in the media, but the war was not. There was a lot of misinformation, as I said, being put into the public at the time about what was actually going on in the Vietnam War. Now, as the monkeys finish their performance, the fans actually rush the stage and tear them apart, as if they were nothing but just an image, a plastic image for them to grab and to take a piece of. And then immediately we're shifted into a clip from an old movie, the Black Cat. And they said, we've given him a very powerful narcotic, which is somewhat of a metaphor, some people think, for what we're seeing, television. You know, you get television as a calming influence. There's also the idea that everything is cut together here on television and presented in an equal way. So it kind of takes away the importance of what might be more important than one other thing, because it's placed side by side. You get, like, war footage, government information placed next to old movies, bad drama, and lame television interviews. We keep getting cuts of a Ralph Williams Ford commercial in here, and the next cut we're going to see, there's a price of $666 on the car, which some people have commented to mean the advertising people may be evil. Now we're into the desert sequence. Shot in Bronson Canyon. There'll be several sequences in the film shot at this location. At the beginning of the sequence, Mickey says, "My canteen once was full," but now it is empty. Which in this sequence, I believe, can mean the excitement and the hope of and the passion. As a person he was running on in the monkeys phenomenon is now running out of it. As you see here, he tried to get a Coca-Cola. And another surreal image here, it's a Coca-Cola machine in the desert. And it is empty. The Coca-Cola machine pretty much represents, at least in this sequence, I think it represents hollow commercialism and Mickey trying to find refreshment and refueling in such an empty commercial product doesn't work for him. And now we get the point that Mickey can't even find anything within himself. He won't even listen to his conscience. I think that one of the themes that keeps coming up is I think that the monkeys, as people in this film, are discovering and trying to fight against their manufactured image. Yet it's not quite possible, necessarily. They do what's expected of them, but they kind of realize the futility of it. So in a way here, Mickey's playing a role, but he's discovering that he should be, he might want to do something other than that. The actor here, the man on the horse, the character's name is the Black Sheik, and the actor is William Bagdad, who appeared as a sheik in an episode of the Monkees TV series called Everywhere a Sheik Sheik, and his character's name was Curad. Coming up here, we have another actor who appeared on an episode of the Monkees TV series. The man coming out of the Italian tank here is named Vito Scotti, and he played a character named Dr. Markovich in the case of the missing monkey. The character that he's playing here, Vito Scotti, is named E. Vitaloni, which is a complete inside film joke because that is the name of a 1953 Federico Fellini film, which has parallels in the Monkees somewhat, that the characters in that film are named after the actors playing them. Bob Rafelson, the director of Head, was very interested in lots of different film styles and in, like, European movements such as the French New Wave, and Italian filmmakers like Federico Fellini. And thinking that, you know, Head being his first film might be his only feature film, he wanted to create a lot of different film styles as well. This whole sequence is very reminiscent of desert epic films such as Lawrence of Arabia. And this is also a very broad joke on the idea that the Italians are always losing and surrendering in war. Although there doesn't really seem to be any war going on. Some people have said that this is a commentary on, like, American dominance. Which also can be taken on another level that that the Monkees as people aren't necessarily interested in dominating as far as politics are concerned, but they want dominance over culture. Whereas Mickey's now deciding that he's just been surrendered to by a bunch of Italians, he's going to destroy the Coca-Cola machine. There's also some kind of strange ideas also out there, because it is said that Mickey came up with the idea for this whole sequence, and that it's a commentary on the fact that he has Italian roots, but that is covered up in the press. We go right into the Can You Dig It sequence, which is kind of like an isolated music video. But I think it kind of transitions, with a happy Mickey face. But I think it's trying to say that because they have the power to kind of control things and do what they want, they become kind of like sedate. And they get comfortable in their success. The belly dancer that you see in close-up right here in the main shot is an actress named Helena Kalinotes. She was a resident belly dancer at a restaurant in L.A., and she went on to be an actress who played the character Palma Potica in Bob Rafelson's film Five Easy Pieces with Jack Nicholson. The song Can You Dig It was written by Peter Tork, but it is sung by Mickey Dolenz. Peter didn't have a lot of luck with his songs in the studio. His voice wasn't thought to be as strong, and in the case where this film was chosen to be in the movie, Peter had originally sang a track on it, but it was requested that Mickey sing a version to be used in the finished film. This came about at a time where the Monkees were under a new kind of recording agreement as the show was coming to an end. Actually, in the second season of the show, they wanted to have more control over their music, and after recording two albums as a band with them playing most of the instruments themselves, they decided that they wanted to produce their own sessions independently. And so each monkey was responsible for hiring the sessions and getting producers and taking care of the sessions themselves. And all the songs were going to be collected on albums under the title Produced by the Monkees. A lot of the songs for the film, Head, were not recorded specifically for it, but were rather culled from the sessions, which led to the album The Birds, the Bees, and the Monkees, which came out in the middle of 1968 while the film Head was in post-production. Several of the songs from that album were recorded even after the songs that were used in this movie, although the soundtrack for Head didn't come out until the end of the year. As the song comes to an end and we're getting ready to go into the next sequence, there's another great transition. We end up on the close-up of the hookah pipe, which is then transitioned into the finger. This is the actress, famous Terry Garr. This is actually her first line spoken in a feature film. She had been a dancer in such programs as the Tammy Show and some Elvis films. She had also been in a failed pilot, which was actually an episode of Star Trek. The pilot was supposed to become a series focusing on a character named Gary Seven, and she was going to play a character named Roberta Lincoln, who was the secretary. We're again spoofing film genres. We have the Western genre, which at the time was very big on television. Shows such as Bonanza and The Big Valley and Gunsmoke were playing up the Old West cliches with Indians. And they were most often shot on sets and studios with very fake backdrops. Now, this is the first indication here that Mickey is realizing that he is fulfilling a role that is imposed upon him, and he's decided to break out of it. The discontent that we kind of saw in the last scene has now become a full-out rebellion, and we're getting a full exposure of the fakeness of everything. This is our first peek at an extended sequence that pops up again over the next bit of the film. It's a spoof of a film called Golden Boy, which is a boxing film where the character actually was a musician who decided to take up boxing. It's a 1939 Columbia picture that starred Barbara Stanwyck and William Holden. We'll see some more of that story coming up here, but as the time being right now... There's more of seeing the fakeness of it all. The monkeys are kind of regrouping together and to kind of break their image. This actor here is Timothy Carey. He's a famous character actor. He got his start in Kubrick films such as Paths of Glory and The Killing. He's also in the original East of Eden, and in some of the beach films, such as Bikini Beach and Beach Blanket Bingo with Annette Funicello. His character here is Lord High and Low, and it pretty much represents the powers that be that were trying to corrupt the monkeys and sell their image and sell byproducts of their phenomenon. And the kind of things that he seems to indicate that are still off target. So he comes off as pretty clueless. We then go into this elaborate sequence where there are a bunch of signs that are given that the monkeys are on their way somewhere. And this gets across the idea that even though the monkeys were popular and well-known personalities, they weren't necessarily respected. And there's an obvious visual image here of, like, the monkeys as people going against the flow of society, the people trying to go one way and they want to go somewhere else. the person we see in the background, the waitress in this restaurant, is played by T.C. Jones. This man was the first widely recognized female impersonator. He even appeared on Ed Sullivan 3 times. The character is named Mr. and Mrs. Ace due to the fact that in the course of a film, it's a she, but in real life, it's a he. Bob Rafelson had said about the casting of the film that everyone else was sort of a loser, a bad guy, someone who'd been condemned. All these people represented what the monkeys were in some way, shape, or form. People had condemned them, and yet they were heroes in other ways. When Mickey had sat down to talk to Peter, asked him what was wrong, Peter had said, I ordered this and now I don't want it. And I think that the ice cream cone is a metaphor for the monkeys' phenomenon. They had all sought out the desire, they had all sought out to be famous and become famous, but now it had become something bigger that they didn't know if they wanted anymore. So, while all the other monkeys are now back to playing roles that are prescribed to them, Mickey's at least contemplating the idea that he shouldn't do it. In this sequence here, we have another example of the Rafelson casting of outcasts. The woman sitting next to Mike in the audience on the right-hand side is a woman named Carol Dotta. A character in the film is here called Sally Silicone, but the Carol Dotta was known as a stripper in San Francisco in the early 60s. She stripped at a club called the Condor, and she was the first to go topless. In 1964, she also underwent silicone treatments and became one of the first women to have artificial breasts. Again, we're here spoofing the idea of boxing films, which were very big in Hollywood. Two of the big ones that are spoofed here are Golden Boy and Kid Galahad. It's such a staple of entertainment that it was even spoofed in an episode of The Monkees, where it was also Davy being a boxer. Here we have Annette Funicello, who is best known for being on the Mickey Mouse Club, but went on to have a career in beach movies with Frankie Avalon in the early 60s. This is a repeat of the scene that we had seen earlier with Davy faking the playing of the violin. This flashback sequence to the story of the boxer actually is intentionally overdramatic, over melodramatic. And the speech that Davy's giving actually even parallels the monkey's phenomenon in a way, and about the idea of what he wants to do versus what they think he should do. And Annette's character says, you have to do it their way. And here we have an even instance of playing up the fakeness, where we see the hand reaching in to apply the tear. And we're immediately broken out of the story and see behind the scenes where Davy goes to pick the boxer that he wants to appear in the film with him. Walking up the stairs and talking to Davy was the director, Bob Rafelson. That was his first appearance in the film, but he'll appear several other times. The boxer is played by Sonny Liston, and the character is called Extra. Now, back into the boxing scene, we're introduced to the idea of the dummy chain, as I call it. Each person is a... Mickey first calls Davy a dummy, Mike calls Mickey a dummy, and somehow this does not sit well with them. And the whole idea of the roles that they're supposed to play is breaking down. And in the whole chaos of the scene, Peter had been back in the restaurant thinking about his place, and he appears here as kind of like an angel to set everyone right on the path that he had always played the dummy. Peter is always the dummy. In the TV series, his character was made out to be the doofus, the guy who could never get anything right. And it dissolves right into the ice cream cone, which I think kind of sells the idea that I was talking about earlier, that the ice cream cone represents something, the fame that he wanted and the things that he didn't expect to come with it but now has to deal with. And even though he'd been thinking he doesn't want to do it, he's drawn back into the whole thing. We have a slew of cameos. This is the director, Bob Rafelson. Behind him is John Anderson, who's a writer and director of the TV series. Jack Nicholson just walked into the scene. Coming into the scene, and just a moment, this is Dennis Hopper walking into the scene. These are all people who worked together at the time and were collaborating, hoping to collaborate on other film projects. And we also have the phenomenon here that as an entertainment phenomenon, everyone seems to love the monkeys, but when we're shown the behind the scenes, they're almost ignored. Nobody really seems to care about them. So now Peter's thinking about the idea of what their role is and what he should be doing. And the whole idea of real versus fake is again brought up here with another transition where fake snow starts to fall in and it transitions into real snowfall, or not real snowfall, but a real snow scene with Peter walking through it. The song, As We Go Along, written by Carole King and Tony Stern. Early on in the production of the film, word had gotten out that they were that the monkeys were appearing in different locations that represented the four seasons of the year. And that's one way to take a look at this sequence. I think another way to look at the sequence is that the monkeys are each isolated in their own location. But as a perception of cutting those locations together into a whole, they're still brought together as a collective. It's still the four monkeys, even though they're in four different locations. I think another interesting thing about this sequence is that it's very reminiscent of a video that was shot a few years later, or a year or so later, by the Beatles for the song Something. This shot here of Davy walking through flowers is very much like a shot that had been used in that music video, which featured the Beatles individually walking with their significant others in nature locations. One thing I think that makes the film interesting to me is I like to think that throughout the film, the monkeys are trying to break out of their image, but they're also trying to escape a sort of a prison that the studio represents. every time they break out of some sort of fake location, they're walking through the back lot of a studio. I think it's even possible that in their contentment, and they think they're in a pleasing location, such as a forest or a snow-covered mountain, that it's really just an illusion if they're still in the studio. And I think that the next thing that's going to happen here at the end of this sequence kind of sells that idea that it's kind of a fake mechanical kind of manipulation, because as soon as you think that everything is nice and calm, they introduce the imposition of a mechanized kind of production line society, intruded by signs and advertising and billboards, which leads again to another great transition where the quick cutting and the increased tempo of the music are dissolved into the sound of a machine clunking away, and it takes us into the factory location, where the monkeys are again, they're uniformed together, they're brought back together, they're playing their role, and they are being toured through the factory, which ironically is the factory which is keeping them in check. The character here, Inspector Shrink, played by Charles McCauley, actually says some interesting things which are rather prophetic in retrospect. Says there's a new world coming with it, whose only preoccupation will be how to amuse itself, and that the tragedy of your times, my young friends, is that you may get exactly what you want. Which at the time was a jab at a probably ignorant society, wasn't paying attention to what was going on in the world, but that has come to kind of grow and become more what's going on in today's society, that everything we want is at our fingertips. The factory here is pumping out generic black boxes, it seems. The boxes don't really show anything in them, what kind of product it might be. And the character is also talking about the machines here as extensions of our brains, to the degree that we can use our brains to control the manipulation. So the monkeys are put in a black box, and the irony of this is that there really was a black box on the set. The monkeys were kind of wild and crazy, and so they built a black box on the set for the second season of their series, where they could go in between takes. There were lights put up so that they could be told which monkey was needed on a set at a time, and they could go on and do whatever they want in their own privacy in that room. Again, we hear Bob Rafelson's voice, the real director, but also the fake director of the monkeys in this film. Here, they don't even seem to be giving any resistance. They're totally into the idea of playing the part that they need to, as directed. And what it comes down to is that they're playing dandruff on the head of somebody, which turns out to be the actor Victor Mature, who in this case is playing the Big Victor, who is a symbol of the big corporation, RCA Victor, who owned everything that the monkeys worked for, their television series and their records and the distribution and everything. And it may be symbolic that in the eyes of the big corporation, the monkeys are actually just a minor thing that can be vacuumed away into a vacuum cleaner when they misbehave or aren't needed anymore. This sequence, which takes place inside the vacuum bag in the vacuum cleaner, is actually very reminiscent of a scene in the Beatles film Help, where Paul McCartney was shrunk down to a small size and played around with oversized props. it's ironic that the film received a G rating, considering this joke here, where Mike picks up the butt and states that it's not one of your standard brands. Some posters in some locations actually had a legend on it that the film was not suitable for children. And the monkeys are still in the box, and they're playing their roles. And it's ironic that Peter says that everybody's where they want to be, which kind of expands on the theme that they're in control of their destiny, but they're allowing themselves to be manipulated. This next sequence is a musical sequence, but it plays on Davey's role as the song and dance man in the show, as the born entertainer who's always looking to fulfill that role. He's put in the spotlight and does the only thing he knows how to do, which is perform. The song is Daddy's Song, written by Harry Nilsson, who also wrote Cuddly Toy for the Monkees' album Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn, and Jones. In the studio, Mike had sung this song, but Can You Dig It, it was decided to have Davey sing this for the film, for the purposes of the story. The visual homage going on here is to musical films, particularly those of Vincente Minnelli, who is Liza Minnelli's father. This is based particularly on a film called Cabin in the Sky, which was an all-black musical, which made stylized use of black and white for costumes and sets. Coming up here, we're going to see Toni Basil, who is the choreographer of this film. She went on to act with Jack Nicholson in Easy Rider and Five Easy Pieces. But most of you might know her for the fact that she had a one-hit wonder song in 1982 called Mickey. By trade, she is still a choreographer. She choreographed many films over the years, including American Graffiti, That Thing You Do, and most recently, Legally Blonde. The ending bit here was recorded on the stage with Davey. On the record, it is a full recorded ending to the song. In keeping with what we had seen earlier, Davey is being rather melodramatic, in keeping with his role as an actor and performer. As Davey disappears to the back and the song ends, we hear the sounds of applause and the sound of a cow. I think, based on the theme of the movie, cutting together images to kind of create a meaning, I think that cutting the sound of the cow together with the applause of the audience kind of indicates a kind of a feeling that they're cattle and being led around. This is Frank Zappa, who appeared in the Monkees TV series at the behest of Mike. His character is called the Critic. And I think what that's meaning, since he's pulling a cow around, and we've linked the people with the cattle, I think that it's indicating the critics leading the people around blindly. He even tells Davey that the youth of America counts on him to show the way. and that's probably only because he tells them to. The actor in the back here, playing the cop, is Logan Ramsey. And keeping with the theme of infamy, it may or may not have been known at the time he was cast, but the father of the actor was the man who sounded the alarm at the attack of Pearl Harbor in 1941. The character's name is Officer Faye Lapid, and the way it's spelled, L-A-P-I-D, seems to be a play on the LAPD, Los Angeles Police Department, and the first name being Faye, F-A-Y-E, may be a play on words replacing the word F-E-Y, rather effeminate. I think it's interesting to note here at this point that the monkeys are now out of a costume. They are no longer in a costume and playing a role. They're somewhat of their own self. But they're still being harassed. They're not welcome. Now, this sequence is a little unusual. To bring Davey back into the scene, he's accompanied by the drill team, which we first saw on the bridge at the very beginning of the film, which sort of links them to a reality. And it's kind of unusual, but I think that my take on it is that the soldiers represent the average person who, even though there are people who kind of detest the monkeys, that even if they do detest them, that they regret being in their respectable jobs and roles that are prescribed to them, and they would rather be performing and entertaining and showing off. Now, we're back in the studio, as I said. Davey excuses himself to the washroom, and we see a bit of the fighter persona. And as he opens the medicine cabinet, there's a big eye. And I think this represents the fact that, as public people, they're always watched. They're always seen. Peter enters, and he's whistling the Beatles' Strawberry Fields Forever. I think the idea is even more sinister that some place that's normally private, like a restroom or a washroom, they can be seen and observed there, kind of hits home that they really are lacking their privacy. And this starts a sequence of the film which is a little unusual that really drives back and forth between being surreal and very real. And I think it's escalating the theme of the film, where you could kind of draw a line between the monkeys as characters and the monkeys as people a little bit in the earlier scenes. Now it's all starting to blend together as it did in real life, that you can't really tell what's what. Now, Davey is all of a sudden in another location, very reminiscent of sets that were seen on their television series. It's very over-the-top and over-designed. Davey's reaction is tough to understand because you can't tell if he's actually frightened by all this or if he's playing the part of someone who is frightened. Although it does appear that wherever he is, he does not want to be there. Another transition to something scary that Davey supposedly sees to something that Mickey's looking at, to this strange sequence of him rolling down a mountain dressed in an explorer outfit, where he's immediately captured by Zulus. And he had said that hits, you know, Lancashire Midget Greeny, because he's looking for Davy, and Lancashire Midget Greeny is a derogatory term, making towards Davy being English and short. And now this seems to draw a parallel between the monkeys being captured and harassed to being backed up against the wall by the police. Now, Mickey's now in a costume, but Peter and Mike are still, they're still in their regular clothes. And here we have another reprise of a theme that I was discussing a few minutes ago, that that the people in regular, respectable lines of work, such as police officer, might be a little discontented and a bit jealous of the idea that people could be performers and make a living at entertaining. And so he does a little dance here while he's alone in the restroom. And very similar to what happened to Davy, he now sees Victor Mature and the location that Davy had been at, which seems to indicate now that perhaps because you're a performer, you're brought under control of the studio, the big Victor, the RCA Victor of the world, now takes control of your performance and what you're doing. This seems to be a dream sequence, but it's also blurred with reality. We're back in the monkey's quote-unquote pad. The man at the door. His character is listed as Heraldic Messenger, but the actor's name is Percy Helton. He's a very well-known character actor, but perhaps he's best known for playing best known for playing Homer Cratchit on the Beverly Hillbillies. Again, it's hard to tell. The monkeys seem to be appearing in their regular clothing and seem to be in their home and everything like this, but they're appearing in strange locations and fulfilling parts. Out of interest, if you could freeze frame on the telegram, it is addressed to, quote, a monkey, and the address is given as 1334 North Beechwood Drive, Hollywood, California, which is consistent with the address given in the TV series. Mike makes a comment about how people consider them plastic, which is very consistent with their real attitudes. And we see another instance of the monkeys being replaced with plastic dummies. The floating pillows here, while being a very, very simple kind of surrealistic dream touch, in some places have been said to be reminiscent of artwork from Andy Warhol at the time. Going back to the theme of different movie styles, this is also very reminiscent of a horror-type movie or suspense-type movie, gothic type of horror. The photo negative effect was a very psychedelic effect used at the time. Very trippy and druggy. Some similar ideas were used in the film The Trip, which Jack Nicholson had written and done with Peter Fonda very soon before making Head. as Mike opens the door to this room, we hear a kind of a chorus humming. This recording is actually the actual monkeys. It was recorded during post-production on the film in August of 1968. So it's probably... on the set, they're probably not singing to a pre-recorded track. Now we discover that this was really just a big elaborate scheme to get Mike out to a birthday party. And the song comes up. It's another Peter Tork song called Long Title, Do I Have to Do This All Over Again? The image of this party is rather disturbing and uncomfortable. While Peter, Davy, and Mickey seem rather into it, Mike is now the person who's out of place and uncomfortable with the kind of image that he needs to fulfill and the things that he needs to do. The party is seen to be kind of a public event with all these people around that he probably doesn't know. It's a public spectacle. It's prepackaged. It's choreographed and it's filmed. We see people kind of creating the mood. We see the people doing the lights and doing the things on the walls and people filming it. Incidentally, since we're listening to a Peter Tork song, there's an interesting story about Peter shooting this film. Peter was the only one who showed up for shooting on the first day. They were scheduled to start on February 11th, 1968, but Mickey, Davey, and Mike had got aligned with an agent named Jerry Parrishino, who went to Bob Rafelson and supposedly got in a fist fight over whether to pay the monkeys more money. Essentially, Peter ended up, according to Peter, he didn't get paid a thing for the film, but the other three ended up getting a $1,000 fee for the film. Another idea that gets across that this is a kind of a public spectacle and prepackaged event is the intercut of the dancing newsreel footage with the actual party. Peter comes up to Mike and makes a comment about him being a millionaire at 25, which is another indicator about the reality of the monkeys as pop stars and a big money-making figure. But Mike is now taking the role of the disenchanted player, not wanting to be part of the mechanized, manufactured image. At first, the crowd seems to be they seem to be shocked by Mike's behavior, at Mike's indignance. But almost immediately, the tide changes and the girls are still screaming and everybody's now cheering Mike on. Kind of trying to seduce him back into his pre-prescribed role because that's what the public wants. Again, we have an appearance by Lord High and Low. And oddly enough, he's wearing a noose around his neck. One way I think this might be interpreted is that with the noose around his neck, he's indicating that Mike's attitude would be the death of his career. And I think that They're trying to shock the monkeys into behaving again by putting on this appearance of a cripple, but they've all decided they all don't know how to react, and they begin laughing. But even though if they're laughing, the gunshot brings them right back into alignment, and the powers that be are controlling them and telling them what to do again. Which then we cut to some public interview footage talking about laughing at people. I think that the reactions of the public here are seem to be rather extreme. But it shows, I think, that the public is very fickle, and that if you get out of line and you say something that might not be very popular, that they're willing to turn on you and willing to discredit you, destroy you, put you in prison. It's the public perception is very very tough, and it's a very hard line to toe. So the monkeys are admonished, and they're figuratively jailed, as we hear strains of guilty. They've now been forced into their roles, captured by the police, the Zulus, whoever we're seeing. We hear a door open, and someone has figured out a way out of this. And we've seen Mickey, Mike, and Davy, so it must be Peter. Davy wakes up and goes to investigate. Davy looks out to see that Peter is conversing with the Swami. The Swami is played by Abraham Sofer. The time the film was written in early 1968, the Beatles had met with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi in England. They had not yet gone to India to study with him. So it's very possible that this was on the minds of people at the time and was seen as an interesting theme to explore in the film. The Beatles' trip to India pretty much coincided with the production of this movie. The Swami is introducing some very important concepts to the theme of the film relating to the difference between the real and the imagined experience. And he says that examining this concept requires energy and discipline. And it puts the effort then on those of us in the audience to put an effort forth to distinguish the real monkeys from the manufactured image of the monkeys. We have another cameo by Sonny Liston. I think in this case is representing the studio trying to obscure the monkeys' perceptions when they think they're on the right track of discovering their own independence and freedom, that they put something in their way to kind of bring them back into control. So all of the monkeys at some point in the film now have had an inkling that things are not quite right, and they've attempted to rebel, but each time has been quelled by the powers that be, and they've been brought back into their pre-prescribed roles. The jumper on the top of the building is played by an actress named June Fairchild. She appeared with Jack Nicholson in a film called Drive, He Said, and she was in Cheech and Chong's film Up in Smoke. She was the girlfriend of Three Dog Night's Danny Hutton, and was given the credit for naming that band. More recently, she was discovered living in L.A.'s Skid Row and was arrested for an open container violation. On the right hand of the frame there, we had seen a woman in an I Dream of Jeannie costume with a belly button visible, which is ironic because the Screen Gems television show I Dream of Jeannie produced by the same people who produced The Monkees, did not allow Barbara Eden as Jeannie to show her belly button. At this point, we're starting to go backwards through the movie and showing locations that we've already been in, the washroom. The whole idea, Peter and Davy are now rebelling against their roles, but they don't really know exactly how to go about it. Peter has an idea that nobody else wants to listen to. Mickey and Mike are pretty much caught up in the things going on around them. Going backwards through the settings to the factory now. They're all back in their uniform costumes. And they're led into the box. But this time, they do seem to notice they're in the box. They immediately notice that something's not quite right. And they know they've been duped, but they don't know how to get out of it. And now we're starting to contrast the real behaviors of the actual people and the monkeys with their television perceptions. And then we get a play on how Peter was the dummy and was never listened to and never allowed to take control and never express any deep experiences or important information. And as Peter points out, they had been pretty much fulfilling their role that was prescribed to them by ignoring him. Peter is now repeating the wisdom given to him by the Swami. And he adds a few words which further drive home the point that they're trying to make. When he talks about the vividly imagined experience, he specifically mentions film, music, and radio, all mediums that the monkeys were controlling or appearing in. He states that these things will separate us from the now, or our reality, unless we pay close enough attention. He repeats the Swami's wisdom about acting with clarity, where there is no choice. But with choice, there is misery. Because the monkeys are not happy, they must have a choice. And because they have choice, they lack clarity. Peter ends by saying that that he actually knows nothing, which is a callback to the ideal that Socrates put forth, to not assume that you know the answers to anything, and that one can only begin to understand the world by realizing that he knows nothing. So in a way, Peter has achieved the ultimate wisdom, but is rejected by Davy. Davy's idea, as has been prescribed by his character throughout the film, has been to fight back. Which is ironic because this is the type of rebellion that Mickey tried, and it failed miserably. So the idea could be put forth that by fighting this system overtly, they're giving into it and making it stronger. Peter's idea, he had actually said to Davy that it doesn't matter if we're in the box. So the idea that Peter has is that the box is someone else's forced perception. Now, this security guard is often mistaken for Tor Johnson, the famous actor and wrestler who was in Ed Wood movies, but it's actually a wrestler named Tiger Joe Marsh. Again, we're going through all the different spoof settings that we've been in, Western settings. And now the monkeys have to confront Lord High and Low, who's been controlling the image and manipulation to the public of the monkeys. Now, it appears that the monkeys are outnumbered, but Davy now is insisting that they stand up for themselves. And at least for the time being, their will has created a way to dominate over these powers. Which is actually a parallel to, for a while, that the monkeys did have control over their kind of marketing. But even though they can tower over the image manipulators, they can't control the large overall corporation. So the big victor is now towering over them and has put them back into the box. And by putting them back in the box this time, they're not only trying to be forced back into their image, but they are being sent to confront every enemy that they've had over the course of this entire film. We have the tank, we have the Italian army. They're the Indians, the security guards, Inspector Shrink, the factory workers, the Big Victor, the Sheiks, and the Coke machine. And each one, in turn, takes their chance at going after the monkeys and trying to destroy them. This shot of the tank chasing the monkeys is actually very reminiscent, again, of the Beatles film Help. Some of these shots are actually very similar. And another irony is that the music to this film was scored by Ken Thorne, who also scored the music to that film. The Big Victor takes his shot and sends the monkeys flying back into their to the studio, where all the other crew and enemies from the film, the people working at the studio, are now ganging up on the monkeys. It seems they have no place particularly to go. And while Mike, Mickey, and Davy end up in the factory and are overwhelmed by the security guards, Peter runs into the Swami again. We have another sequence of scenes on televisions being clicked back and forth, kind of creating their own context. It started off with Rita Hayworth in the movie Gilda. We're cross-cutting here an animated gun with a real reaction from news footage. We have a bit of a Hanna-Barbera loopy-de-loop cartoon. There's advertising. And this is John Brockman, who created the marketing campaign for this movie. Again, the whole intercutting of these different things seems to point out that the perception of the public is created by the media putting all these images together in a particular way. We're back to spoofing Hollywood genres again. Peter had been been with the Swami now, was separated from the group, and now can rescue them from the factory. And we go into a silent movie spoof, which started off with a James Bond kind of music spoof and a spy movie spoof. I suppose the way that the rest of this movie can be described is just entropy, where everything starts to collapse in on itself and destroy. The monkeys are taking their shot at destroying pretty much the studio. That giant telephone played a role in an episode of The Monkees one time, The Monkees on the Line. But even if the monkeys can escape the walls of the studio, they can't escape the corporation who's taking control of their lives. And ironically, the big victor, by smashing the television, has now destroyed the method by which they control the public perception of the monkeys, and the monkeys are allowed to escape. It was also revealed that he was the hand that was controlling the images on the television, further linking the big corporations with the media organization and the media perceptions. And as the monkeys escape and run onto the bridge where we saw at the beginning of the film starting, they are now being chased by all those adversaries that we'd seen throughout the film. And seeing that the forces are inescapable, they are now all jumping off the bridge to commit a figurative suicide, to get away from the inescapable media manipulation. Now, just a technical note, this sequence and the very similar one at the beginning of the film, there are some points at which you can see black bars at the top and the bottom of the screen. The reason for this is that this transfer on this disc was done from a full 1:33:1 ratio element, where if projected in a movie theater, the projector would have a mat in it that would crop off the top and the bottom of the image, thus those sections that you can see black at the bottom would not be projected onto the screen. There was a case earlier in the film where a boom microphone was seen at the top of the screen, which is another thing that would have been cropped out by the projector. To fix this problem, the transfer could have been letterboxed, but Rhino decided that they would create a full-frame version of this film to preserve all the picture information. Now, in contrast to the opening shots underwater, which were shot in the Bahamas, these shots are actually just the four monkeys in a swimming pool. And going back to the theme of escaping by jumping, the irony is that by trying to escape their confinement in the box, the monkeys have now put themselves in a more restrictive place. They are now underwater where they can't even breathe, so their escape has put them in a place which is even more suffocating. And to completely put a cap on it, is that they're not only underwater, but they're tapped in a tank. They're trapped in a tank, which is still under the control of the big victor. Which gives a rather downbeat message, I think, that no matter what you do, if you want to be famous and you get to be there, you get what you want. It's a hard trap to escape. Now, coming up here, there are some credits that are backwards in the screen, and I'll read them off to you very quickly myself so that you don't have to try and figure them out. They said, Hero, Terry Chambers. Nothing, Mike Burns. Mother, Esther Shepherd. Girlfriend, Christine Helstosky. The Sex Fiend, John Hoffman. Lover, Secretary, Linda Weaver. And the last name at the bottom of the screen is Jim Hanley, which is placed next to the word Frotis, which is not a backwards word, but is the name of the alien in the last episode of The Monkees, directed by Mickey Dolenz, called the Frotis Caper. There we have the backwards credits. And while we're talking about credits, I'd like to thank some people who put ideas out there in the world and on the internet for me to cop from for this commentary. We have Terry Canote, Donatella DeBono, Cassidy Fontana, V. Emerson, Rox Ellen, Aaron Handy III, Megan Jennifer, Psycho Jello, Sleepy Jean, Teresa Marrier, and Louise Ward. If you go to the location where you downloaded this file, you can find some links to some great information on Head on the Internet. And I'd like to thank you, and have a lovely day.